Welcome to Lawmen, a podcast about local legends and obscure curiosities from days of yore. I am Alistair Beckett King.
And I'm James Shakeshaft.
And James, what is this I have here? Why, it's a deputy law person.
Yes.
In actual fact, it's Sasha Coward, author of the upcoming Queer as Folklore, which is an LGBTQ history of various folkloric creatures and myths.
And he's an actual folklorist, and he's really funny.
And he designs escape rooms. What's not to like? So, with some slightly more serious subject matter than our usual murders and beheadings, I present Sasha Coward and the vampire.
You're spelling that with a Y, Sonny.
I'm spelling it with all the Ys. It's actually a Yampia. Howdy there, James.
Howdy. Have a nice day.
Is that what howdy means? Have a nice day?
I don't know. I thought we were being Americans.
Oh, I see. Because howdy could be have a nice day. It could be a contraction of that.
Got to be like, how do you do?
How do you do? Yeah, that's, how do you that's do? Clearly, howdy, what, it, clearly what it means. All right. Howdy. Well,
howdy.
James.
Yes.
We've got a little guest for you.
Oh, yeah. Go on.
I'm immediately regretting the word little because actually I think Sasha is probably one of the largest guests we've had.
It's life size.
Yeah, he's a full-size human person. Sasha Coward. Hello, Sasha.
Hello.
Hi, Sasha.
And let me know if I have this right. You are a museum...
A life-sized human.
A life-sized human
average,
being.
Not larger than average.
I don't know. I've seen photographs on the internet of your biceps, and they are...
Oh, dear.
Next to a pound coin for scale.
They are... I believe the word is swole. Is that correct?
Well, thank you. Thank you kindly. I'm already dying inside. This is a fantastic introduction to me as an academic and historian, well-respected folklorist.
I did not mean to objectify you so early on in the podcast. It's just that the reason I say that is a lot of jocks listen to this podcast because they know that I, ABK, am a jock. Obviously, James is more on the nerd side.
Big time.
And occasionally we want to throw the jocks something, which is like, you know, a sort of muscular guy as a guest. But you are more than just a man with arms who is of normal size. You are also a museum worker and folklore expert and escape room designer.
Yeah, I'm the most hipster person you've ever had to introduce, I'm going to imagine. Folklorist and escape room designer.
Yeah, yep. Wearing an avocado monocle.
Wait, is the museum, was that an escape room that went wrong?
Well... I do design escape rooms for museums. It's very friggin' niche, but it does link together, but
yeah.
It does come out as very disparate. It all comes from the same place,
yes.
But it all sounds very eccentric when you say it.
The listeners to the Lawmen podcast will be like, niche, and they'll be tearing their headphones off and throwing their Walkmans away. The idea that we would cover a niche topic. But you properly know your stuff. Normally we get comedians on who essentially take the mickey, mock the whole premise of the podcast in offensively guttural Yorkshire accents.
Chris Cantrell, this is.
Well, it's naming no names.
Well, his name's Chris Cantrell.
Well, he does have, yes, his name is Chris.
He does have a name.
Yeah, unfortunately. But you've really done your research. You've got a book called Queer as Folklore, which is the hidden queer history of myths and monsters. And
yeah.
That name is a really good pun, but
excellent.
Like the really good pun that is the title of our podcast, I wonder if it would work for Americans, because do Americans know the phrase queer as folk, or there's nout as queer as folk?
So we were worrying about whether it would translate. If we're lucky enough to do well in America, we're thinking maybe a title like Monsters in the Closet would do the same
Ooh.
Job,
nice.
But for an audience that didn't know queer as folk. Then again, the TV series was turned into an American show called Queer as Folk.
With the set, and it wasn't like Queer as Folk US.
Didn't like The Office.
Yeah, they don't think they added an addendum to that. But yeah, it's bloody terrifying and exciting writing a book, first book. And I have to admit, like, the title came first. I'm only writing a book because there's a cool title.
What better reason to write a book than because you've got a cool title? That's fantastic. Mm. Is a Yorkshire phrase, nout as queer as folk, is how I imagine it. It's how I imagine hearing it in my head.
It's an old English phrase that kind of would have been used everywhere. but it's kind of stayed in like parlance in like Yorkshire and other parts of the UK, which sounds a bit dated in other places. But it's got quite a history itself. Obviously not with the contemporary meaning of queer, meaning lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, what have you. It just meaning odd. People are weird.
Yeah. They are weird. So this really, it caught my eye because I don't think it's an angle we've looked at really in many episodes. And I was surprised by some of the things I was hearing from you. You know, there were sort of stories and angles on the supernatural and the mysterious and the folk that I didn't know anything about. So I was really glad that you decided to come on the podcast. Do you have a folk icon that you'd like to introduce to the pod?
The thing is, we're not going to be talking about this icon. My personal favourite folklore creature is the mermaid. I've got a bit of an obsession, not that kind of obsession, to some of the very strange direct messages that I've received. There's like no kink shaming here. If you like mermaids that way, fantastic, awesome. Not me, but I do love that as a figure. That's kind of what got me into mythology and folklore. But what I was hoping we could talk a bit about is vampires, just because the queer story, I think, the history and queerness of vampires is so meaty. Like there's some really good stuff there. There's a lot of spurned lovers. There's a lot of just interesting places that takes us. So I thought that would be a cool one to dissect.
Oh yeah.
Weirdly, I don't think we haven't had a lot of vampires on the show.
Not knowingly. but also not done it as a story. No.
No, I can't think we haven't covered many vampire legends.
They tend to be quite like well-known vampires on the whole.
Well, not to show off, there's Dracula.
Mr. Dracula.
That's
just
that's an example of a vampire I've heard of.
You are clearly a vampire, like a niche fantasist there, knowing Dracula. That's very...
Better than aficionado.
Exactly, yes.
I'm kind of into vampires. You probably haven't heard of them.
A bit of a vampire sommelier.
Nosferatu. Does the film ring any bells? F.W. Murnau's silent film.
Well, isn't Dracula, old Dracula's, famous enough that I've seen a picture on social media of a sign in Whitby Abbey saying, "Stop asking us where Dracula's grave is." He's a fictional character.
But he's also, even in the book, not buried in Whitby Abbey, is he? That doesn't happen in the book.
That's the last place you look for a vampire is in the ground. Famously, not really buried at all.
You're right. That is one of the main things about Dracula, is that he's very much up and about.
He's undead. That's the name.
One of my favourite things about Dracula is that the characters in Dracula haven't read Dracula. And it's so famous now that it's hard to read it without going, "It's Dracula! He's Dracula!" Because it's incomprehensible that they live in a world where they don't... And we'll leave garlic around, and then a maid comes and goes, "What's all this garlic in here? I'll clear that out of the way." It's like, "What are you doing? There's a Dracula on the loose!"
Yeah.
That's ridiculous behaviour.
Every vampire red flag.
They don't know about Dracula. Now, vampires are a good analogue for a group of people that mainstream culture wants to have a go at, I think.
Yeah. They're very saucy, though, aren't they?
They're sexy. They're camp as, you know, they're monstrous. They're monster. Like, it's all of the classic A-level queer history essay about vampires. Like, the basic thing is, there's kind of a baseline why vampires resonate with queer people, why we see ourselves in the vampire. We see ourselves in the monster a lot of the time. But the thing with the vampire is there's certain tropes. If you take your classic male and female vampires, so you've got your Dracula, right? Mm-hmm. And Dracula's got a little bit more hunky with time. He wasn't necessarily originally in the first book, right? He wasn't a sex symbol, but he was quite refined. Mm. And, you know, he was a wealthy single man living in a whacking great big castle, you know, flouncing around.
High disposable income.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. The pink pound, as it might be said. But that archetype of like the kind of the well-dressed, well-groomed, like ridiculously well-groomed gentleman with refined taste living by himself in the crumbling old ruin. Like, that is a really interesting idea. If you think about like gay and bisexual men living around the same time, not having families, being a bit eccentric, mm-hmm. possibly with certain fashions and tastes that would make them stand out a little bit. You could imagine the weird old dude living in that big house is very much the vampire.
The villagers are going to be whispering, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they'll be whispering anyway. But yeah, exactly. If you are flouncing around with a cape, I would hope they'd be whispering. I mean, if I had a great big cape, I'd want some whispers.
Well, that's why you get a cape, really, isn't it? Is this whisper material? I think so.
Yeah.
It's odd that Batman chose a cape to try and sort of blend in to the night, whereas a cape is... It's one of the most flamboyant choices you can make, apart from a fedora.
You're not implying there could be a gay subtext to Batman, surely?
What? Surely.
No.
Straight as they come.
He wouldn't have time. He's got to look after his ward.
Have you seen Thor, like great big muscular shirtless dude walking around? You know, yeah, super heterosexual, definitely not partly created by queer people. But that's the thing, like the story that interests me is that there are these characters, like you said, Dracula, super well known, and we think we know them, and then you like look under the cape a bit and there's all this weirdness, and there's these interesting stories of how we got to this vampire archetype who has shifted. Like if you'd gone and spoken about vampires 400 years ago, you wouldn't be talking about a well-dressed sexy dude in a fancy house or glittery Robert Pattinson. Like these are very much modern representations, but the journey from the ancient monstrous creature that was barely human, like more Nosferatu, to Count Dracula and then on to Twilight, it's a queer journey. It's a story that is told by and layered with queer lives, which I find fascinating.
But it occurs to me when you're talking about that, we also have, I suppose, writers like M.R. James.
Mr. James,
who we don't know, but probably gay. And, you know, thinking of the older gentlemen who live alone and who have had a significant influence on uncanny and weird literature. I think there's more than just M.R. James. I suppose.
Well, there's Bram Stoker, right?
I didn't know. Yeah.
Many of his biographers have guessed or alluded to his sexuality. Bram Stoker was very close friends with a number of queer writers at the time, a number of gay men. He wrote a letter that was very mysterious to a friend of his that basically said, if you know what I'm talking about, then you'll understand my feelings. But if you don't, please burn this letter.
Oh.
So there's all of this allusion to sexuality. And I'm not going to say that he was gay. I don't have the evidence of that. But his own biographers have said he codified his sexuality in such a weird and hidden way and later turned on other gay writers. He actually went on a bit of a witch hunt, saying that there were far too many like sodomites amongst the writers, that they should be weeded out. This is obviously after Oscar Wilde and all of this, maybe to protect his own identity by projecting. So, yeah, I would very much say amongst these Gothic writers who are definitely a bit bent, I would include Bram. Mm.
And so what is the sort of archetype of the vampire? Is Bram Stoker the original modern version of the vampire? Or not?
Not at all. Like everyone's inspired by someone, and Bram Stoker was directly inspired by another story, which was called The Vampire, which is spelt with a Y, which means I always want to pronounce it really weird, like vampire.
I think
like
that's correct. Vampire. Yes, I think our listeners will be very upset if we're not vampiring.
That means it's like extra spooky as well.
Yeah, you want to get a bit funny in the mouth with it, right?
Is that Sheridan Le Fanu? I've heard of vampires.
So Le Fanu didn't write Vampire. He wrote Carmilla.
Oh, no, right? I was wrong.
Any wise in that?
No wise, but there are lesbians. That's also
because I was trying to remember. I was thinking of Olala, which is Robert Louis Stevenson, I think. And I thought that was lesbian vampires. But is Is this one lesbian vampire? There can't be two books with lesbian vampires in. Come on.
Oh, my God. There are so many. So this is the thing that fascinates me. The vampire that we have, like, in a sense, that the illusion I use is that they have, folklorically speaking, God, that's a horrible phrase. That makes me sound terribly pretentious. But they have, like, a mother and a father. And the father is queer and the mother is also queer, unsurprisingly. So the father is probably the character in Vampire that was based on Lord Byron. So we're talking about the bisexual menace, the mad who was mad, bad, and dangerous to know, who, whilst he was hanging out with Mary Shelley, who started writing Frankenstein that same night, that they had a competition to write a ghost story. And he started writing a thing that he called a fragment that was about a mysterious man who might be a vampire. He got bored of it. And one of his little lovesick, well, I'd say cronies, I feel that's a bit mean, but one of his mates, Polidori, takes this fragment and turns it into the vampire. And then after being very much reviled and rejected by Byron, in fact, he earns the nickname Polly Dolly from Byron, tries to smack him in the back of the head with an oar once they're rowing. They have a horrible relationship. Oof. And so he turns the character that Byron wrote into a parody of Byron. Byron, the sexy, wealthy, narcissistic dude, becomes this count, this vampire who is dangerous in many different ways, dangerous to love as well as dangerous to be bitten by. And he tries to actually end up almost getting published, and it gets misaccredited. Even though Polidori actually finished it and wrote it, it's made to be written as Byron's again. Byron doesn't want to have anything to do with it, because it's a mocking piece of writing about him being an evil vampire. And Polidori's devastated because it's his work. And it later results in Polidori basically taking his own life by drinking poison. So you've got this crazy story started by Byron, and then that becomes the sexy gentleman vampire. Yeah.
Wow.
Does that establish any of the tropes of the vampire then, of the drinking of the blood or the fear of the cross? Because I suppose they're not having a reflection. It's quite a burn on Byron.
Yeah. I mean, the burn, I think, was the novel thing, or the new-ish thing, was that it was not a monster, it was a man, and that the man was wealthy and respected. And that was clearly like Byron. That was this is talking about a man who loves himself a bit too much, who everyone else adores, but is evil inside. The blood sucking, I mean, that's ancient. We're talking going back to ancient Greece, the Empusa, Lamia, like classical vampires that were barely human, often feminine in form. So we're like succubuses and incubuses as well, demons that would take blood. The vampire is more of a monster. He doesn't really look very human and might be able to transform to look human, but the sexy or at least respectable vampire as a man more or less starts with this interaction with Byron and Polidori and the vampire there, the vampire, whatever.
Byron spelt with a Y as well.
Oh my God, do you think?
Vinir Byron.
Byron.
I can't remember if we covered Dr. Polidori and any of the others when we talked about Shelley's ghost.
I think in The Year Without a Summer, we did.
The Year Without a Summer.
About the vampire being written.
Yes. Yeah, so it's I had heard some of that, even though I got it wrong and thought it was Sheridan Le Fanu. Throughout that, I wanted to put my hand up and be like, I've heard about this. Be like, that's what I was like in school. Just like whenever something I knew about came up, I was really annoying to be like, me. I didn't mean Sheridan Le Fanu. I meant Dr. Polidori.
Alistair, I imagine that, like, both the host and everyone you have in your podcast were that child at school. So yes. I wouldn't worry.
That's the entire listenership. When we do live shows, hands are up almost. People are, you know, when you've got your hand up and it's getting tired, so you're using your other hand to prop up. Yeah. So we're like, I have an answer.
More of a statement than the question.
This shift from a nasty, grizzled, supernatural monster to a hot, posh guy.
Yeah.
We've all done it. we've all had a glow up.
And what a glower. So this is happening in the gothic revival in literature. This is happening in the 19th century.
Yeah, so 19th century, you see some of it maybe starting a little bit earlier. So with the female vampire in the 18th century, we start to get depictions like Le Fanu of the sort of lesbian, although obviously not described that way, but the sexy countess, often a wealthy, mysterious vampire woman who preys on another young woman. Who basically seduces her, who comes at night. But the object of desire, whether it's a male vampire or a female vampire, is nearly always the woman. So you end up with this queer succubus, who is also, she's a bit of an older woman often, but is still hot. She's still beautiful in kind of a gothic and exoticized way. So she becomes any weird woman, just like the vampire man becomes any weird man. So yeah, like any mannish woman who is physically aggressive or impressive, any kind of woman that, you know, that folklore stories of doing weird things with blood, of having rituals, of seducing women. Like if we think of the way that witches are supposed to recruit, it is often the hag takes a younger, beautiful woman under her thrall, and she is then embraced into the world of witchcraft. So it's the same sense of like an older woman who is predatory. In some sense. And she, like, so her legacy is going back probably a lot earlier. So we're talking going back to biblical stories, stories around the Torah. So not necessarily Judaism itself, but kind of the mysticism around the Torah. Writes of there being a that before Eve in the Garden of Eden, there was Lilith. And Lilith refused to lie for Adam. So she would not basically have sex with him. She wouldn't be a wife. And so she is cursed, kicked out of Eden, and turned into a monster. And that monster is very specifically described, Lilith or Lilitu, as being vampiric. She preys on men and she sucks their blood. So the mother of vampires may in some stories have started in the Garden of Eden as an alternative to Eve. And then her children become vampires. The mother there is this demonic seductress who in some images, so there's woodcuts from Germany that show Lilith re-entering the Garden of Eden as the snake and seducing Eve to eat the apple. So sexually, possibly taking Eve and being this, like, you know, predatory lesbian that makes Eve make that great mistake. So yeah, it's a whole thing.
I like that they brought the character back for that, but that's quite Bible extended universe. It's still a bit like Star Wars. It's always got to be someone related to someone.
What I like about those sorts of the Rosicrucians and the people who are into the Kabbalah is that a lot of it feels like sort of Bible fanfic, where they're like, wouldn't it be, what if this person was actually that person? Like if we were on the wiki of going in and editing Lilith's wiki to add, and then she came back as the snake.
Yeah, totally. Like Aleister Crowley was totally just that was what he was doing. He was making his own fanfic, but turning it into a weird sex cult. It was all just like, Horus and Osiris come down, but they have sex with demons, and I'm the prophet, and they're all really sexy. And you're like, this is what a 14-year-old would have written in 2006 as part of the Harry Potter / fiction that I remember reading. It's the same thing.
I do always think that picture, the famous picture of Aleister Crowley, where he's got the hands by his face, really does look like he's having a bit of a sulk.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think he wanted to wear that pyramid hat.
His mum had forced him to wear his pyramid.
Put on your nice pyramid hat. There's a photographer coming. Alistair!
I'll pose, but I'm not smiling. I don't know where Aleister Crowley was from.
I'm writing about Aleister Crowley at the moment because a chapter on demons, and he's one of those people that, like, he shouldn't be your idol. He's a totally messed up, weirdo, unpleasant dude, but fascinating. And I do, again, I think his bisexuality comes into play there, right? When you know that you are growing up in an Edwardian, just after the Edwardian period, and you like guys and girls, it's a way to create the space To have the kind of sex and relationships you want. Like, not every bisexual creates, you know, a massive demonic love sex cult. I mean, they should.
that's no bi erasure here. What a wonderful footnote. Not hashtag not every bisexual person does that. Just for legal reasons, we have to be clear that not everyone.
Not every single one, no.
I've met
some that haven't. the thing I noticed, though, is that he found all this esoteric, weird mysticism and stuff because he thought that was kind of a safe place, partly to have the kind of sex that he wanted. I mean, this is a guy that put, like, a giant penis in his signature.
Was he 13 when he did that?
Like, this is what I'm saying. This is why it's like that fanfic / fiction. Like, you know, oh, and these are my favorite. This is my favorite demon, and that's my favorite Egyptian god. And they both have big willies, and then they have lots of sex. I've got a copy of the Lesser Keys of Solomon, which is like this text. It's basically the Pokemon of demons, how to catch them all. And Aleister Crowley has written his own introduction that's completely unintelligible, but very fun. And in the margins, he's drawn his own little demons, and they all have massive willies, like literally every single one. Even when the description does not say that they're priapic and have big willies, no, Alistair's drawn like a great big horn guy, and they're all kind of like winking or like sort of it's great. I love it.
We had textbooks like that in school, though. It was not the Lesser Key of Solomon, but no, it was, yeah. Avantage.
Tricolet.
Le Tricolore, yeah.
And the German textbook where they foolishly made the main character a sausage. Unbelievable.
You're asking for trouble there. Come on.
Do you remember at school, you'd have like a textbook and someone would write on one page, turn to page 45, and then you and then turn to page 20, and you'd be going backwards and forwards, mm-hmm. and then it would always be a willy at the end.
Yeah. It's, yes, it's the Aleister Crowley escape room, but in book form.
In a book, yeah.
We do remember that, and I'm confident every single listener to the podcast was a fan of those weird sort of
My favorite of those was some wag at our school did like a classic, like on page 23 it said turn to page 45, mm-hmm. page 45 it said turn to page 23.
What?
Or they've got you, you're in an infinite loop.
Oh,
there's probably some kid that's still there.
So that is
the story of the vampire. Thank you. So one of the things that I guess the common theme here is that in drawing a parallel between the perception of vampires and perceptions of queer people, there's an obvious negative bent there. So how do you feel about that?
I think it's there already anyway. So if we look at the way the vampire has been portrayed, so during like the Hays Code, which was the restrictive code for Hollywood, which basically meant you couldn't depict anything that was deemed immoral, which include people like me. Well, I mean, we are deeply immoral, but you know, you should still depict us as fair representation. But because of that, the way that people would get around it was by showing queerness as the monster or the serial killer, which is why we get the trope of Dracula having such a, you know, a swish and flick, and there is a flourish. And because of that, I feel that explaining why that is and taking some ownership and taking some strength in that is way better than just like pretending it's not there. And I think that if you know, and you know, I'm sure you've got tons of LGBT friends and listeners, we actually really love those labels. We've reclaimed them, or many of us have. You go to a pride parade, you are going to see fairies, unicorns, mermaids, vampires, devils, demogorgons, you name it. We sort of know how society has historically seen us. So what I'm trying to do in the book is kind of say, hey, you're not just borrowing these weird labels. You haven't gone to like a, you know, Halloween fancy dress shop and you're trying something on because you're a weirdo. You actually helped craft these. You're part of the story of why we have these amazing monsters. Like, you're not just going, oh, these are camp and fabulous, let's use them for a bit. It's a lot deeper. And to understand the story of the vampire, it tells you the story of people like us throughout history, how we were treated and seen. So I find it empowering. I would rather reclaim the monster than shove it back in the closet.
That's what a good ending there. That I feel like we want to cut straight to credits, but unfortunately, that's not how this podcast works. But like, we need a music sting there. I'm trying to think of contemporary representations of vampires, and I suppose Twilight is the most famous, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which as it goes on gains a few gay characters,
a few
queer characters. I'm trying to remember.
You've got Willow. So Willow being your archetypical gay witch, lesbian witch.
Yeah. But it does still feel like, is it fair to say that vampires are still kind of coded? And I'm trying to, there are no big gay vampire franchises that come to mind.
100%. And there are, I often, as a historian, I like it when we talk about, I like to talk about facts, or I like to talk about this piece of folklore, this person, and be a bit more kind of rigorous rather than, oh, it feels kind of camp or it's a bit fabulous, because that can often just be seen as, well, that's just my opinion. But there are loads of people that have looked at Twilight and have said things like, so Edward in Twilight, if it wasn't for the fact, the one thing that makes him not gay is that he's apparently attracted to the main character. Through some bizarre, like, only this one character, only this woman, no other women ever, just this one woman. But in every other sense, he sparkles in sunlight. Like, he is in some ways sexless, like the gay best friend. He's very pretty. He's cold and distant and aloof. So he's still coded. And then if we look at like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, if someone gets bitten and becomes a vampire, you'll notice they just become a gayer version of themselves. Like when Angel, the kind of, vampire boyfriend of Buffy, becomes a proper vampire again, he just gets more gay. Like that's how you know he's a vampire. He gets forehead wrinkles and big teeth, and suddenly is just, rhapsodizing about how he's going to destroy the world and watch it burn with a glass of blood in one hand. Like it's written in there. Whether it's not intentional, I don't think these people creating this are like, oh, we're going to lean into the queer archetype here. It's just that what a vampire is. This is really tacky, but the blood that flows through the veins of the contemporary vampire is queer. It is so originating from stories of weird men and women, of deviant lust, of gender transgression, of masculine women and feminine men, of actual authors, writers and creators who were themselves queer, that the end product, like whatever you do with it, like, you can try and make the straight vampire telling you possibly can. I'm still going to see it as queer. To be honest, the only film, and I've not seen this, that I think is probably pretty heterosexual is that lesbian vampire film.
Oh, yeah. Is it Jimmy Corden?
The James Corden.
Buddy Corden,
the James Corden film. I can't believe none of us have seen this
lesbian vampire killers.
Lesbian vampire killers is probably the greatest vampire film that's ever been made, which is wonderfully ironic, isn't it?
So I think, unfortunately, now we're left with a situation where we have no choice but for James and I to cishet white men to now pass judgment upon everything you just told us. I don't know if there are any other podcasts where white men say their opinions. So we may have invented that idea. So are you ready to be scored?
Yeah, score me.
What is your first category?
So the first one's going to be about names.
Okay. I was very impressed about the fact that your book has potentially two names.
Mm. Yeah.
That's quite cool.
That is good. And that, I mean, there's some good author names that I think we've overlooked in the past. Bram Stoker.
Yes.
Yeah. That's Lefanu.
Sheridan Lefanu. Lefanu. Yeah.
It sounds like an insult in like primary school. Pretty good. Polly Dolly. Polidori, that's quite fun.
Even Polidori is a good name.
Mm.
What was it? Was his first name John? That's a really low-key name.
It was
John Many Doors.
Many Doors.
It's Italian for lots of doors, yeah.
And then you've got the vampire with a Y, right?
Vampire.
Vampire, yes.
Vampire.
Byron, the burger guy. obviously invented fancy hamburgers, I believe, in the UK, pretty exclusively.
That's another joke we'll have to translate for Americans. Thanks, James.
Yeah. He's like a sort of... Byron is kind of a British Wendy's.
It's like a pretentious Wendy's. Mm.
What is the difference between a Wendy's and a Denny's?
Wendy's burgers are mm-hmm. square.
What?
Yeah.
No, they're really not. Good.
They've got corners, which gives you extra bit of crispiness, which is great to my mind.
What, the meat patty itself is square?
Yep.
Nah.
No, it is.
Couldn't happen. I don't believe it. Nah.
You can tessellate them and everything.
No, it didn't happen, no.
It's a ham squarger. Ham squarger? Does that work?
Yes.
Please cut that out.
It's made out of ham squarger.
No, I would love to cut it out, but I'm afraid ham squarger is quite a good word. It's quite a good name, so that's actually going to add to the category, I think. I'm going to go with a 3, I think. That's my suggestion. What do you think, James? Am I being too harsh, too generous?
Yeah, I feel like I've let this down. I should have said exsanguination a lot, because that's a great word.
That's a really good word. It's such a... there's no way... exsanguination happens enough that you need a word for it, I think.
It's like a defenestration kind of vibe,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it occurred to me in English, we don't have a word for the thirsty version of starving. I guess that's because it's too wet here for us to need a word for it. I wonder if languages in hotter places have a word for that.
Parched.
Parched. Yeah, no,
absolutely parched.
But you can't die of parchation, can you? We don't have a word. You can be thirsty. You can be paggering.
Dehydration.
Dehydration. But that could be applied to, like, coffee or anything. You know, anything can be dehydrated. A packet of mixed nuts could be dehydrated.
I feel like the more that we inspect this, what sounded like a really grand statement, the more it starts to fall apart. Like
all right,
tissue paper.
I didn't realise I was on trial here. It's 4 out of 5.
I'm not earning myself any points, am I? It's gone down to 2.
Now, it's 4 out of 5. Let's move on and let's all forget that whatever it was I said that might have been wrong. Sasha, what is the second category?
The second one is rating out a supernaturalness. What is the qualities that make this supernatural?
Ever so.
Well, vampires are pretty sky high, although several of the ones we've talked about have been works of fiction. So does that count?
Yeah, but we did do like a long little preamble around Aleister Crowley.
Crowley, yeah. There's him with his hat.
Grumpy Aleister Crowley.
That's not natural, that hat. That's got to be supernatural.
That's not a naturally occurring headpiece.
And if you are claiming that the Garden of Eden and Lilith is not 100% accurate, you will have some very interesting Twitter messages. That's all I'm going
to
say.
We do occasionally upset the American conservatives who listen to the podcast for reasons that escape me.
Mm.
They listen so that you can tell them what a Denny's is, I think.
It's square. The burgers are square.
That's
this
Wendy's.
Limey don't believe our burgers are square.
Wendy's is square burgers. What? Denny's is moons over my hammy.
Who? You're just saying noises. Moons over my hammy.
Moons over my hammy. You could have had that in the names round.
Moons over my hammy?
Moons over my hammy. It's a pun I don't understand. It's one of those American phrases I don't understand. Moons
the
over
moon
my hammy is a breakfast.
He's everywhere.
Option.
The moon doesn't just belong to Miami. There's
no,
moon
my,
over
hammy,
my
hammies.
My hammies?
My hammies, because it's got ham in it. It's like a ham square burger.
This podcast is so educational today. What the category was supernatural.
The category was breakfast items.
We had Crowley. We had Lilith. We had all of that. The snake in the Garden of Eden.
The Garden of Vegan?
The Garden of Vegan, yeah.
Oh, my God.
You are allowed to eat the apples.
Yeah, go what? That's all we got.
Have an apple. It's got to be 5 out of 5 for supernatural.
Mm. Yeah.
What other explanation could there be for vampires or men who wear cloaks and are slightly fabulous, as you put it? What is your next category?
A bit of a pun.
Excellent.
Coming out of the coffin.
That probably the first pun that's happened on this podcast.
Yep. I'm sure it is.
Well, that is what vampires do, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, but we're doing this in a, like, yeah, literal, but also queer figuratively as well. So you got to factor that in.
It's got two layers.
Yeah.
It does.
Like a ham squarger.
Yeah, like a ham squarger.
Oh, your artful reintegration of the ham squarger there. That's worth points, surely.
I mean, you're definitely copyrighting it for yourself. This is...
Did I convince you that vampires are just very queer?
I think I am convinced. As the arbiters of all things, I feel completely confident about speaking out on this issue.
Yes, absolutely. I could see a vampire poinging out of that coffin in the old sort of Hammer films. There's nothing to be read into that at all. No, yeah, absolutely.
The thing is, I love the idea of them rising out, and rather than everyone screaming, they're like, oh my God, well done. Oh, congratulations. I'm so happy. Ah! Like...
Under those circumstances, how could it be anything other than 5 out of 5 for coming out of the casket? Are we saying casket? Coffin? Crypt? Could be anything.
Coming out. Mm. All right, so I've got the final category.
Yes, Lefanu category.
No. Lefanu category. I'm not grading you, but I would have given you a 5 out of 10.
Thank you.
Okay, so the final category, I'm going to call it hot-bloodedness. So we're talking about pure, raw sexuality. How sexy were these stories?
I'm glad you came to James and I, the expert, on pure, raw sexuality. That's what it says in the bio of the website. That's what it says in the podcast information section in the description.
I mean, it's what it says in all the reviews.
All the reviews are like 5 out of 5. And then they say raw, hot sexuality. They rarely even add context. They don't say what they're referring to. I don't think some of them have been listening to the podcast, but I'm not
going to. I was a little surprised when I actually came on the podcast after seeing all those reviews. I was expecting something slightly different, but.
Yeah, sorry. I feel like we got you on under completely false pretenses. Yeah, okay. I think vampires are quite sexy.
Yeah, massively so. Every single one apart from the beginning of Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, where Gary Oldman looks like a scrotum.
But the thing about Dracula is, even when sometimes he's a wolf, sometimes he's a cloud of bees.
Oh, hot bees.
So, no, he's never a cloud of bees. That's not canon. I think I meant to say flies. Yeah, no, sometimes he's just a swarm of lizards. He can be anything. Like, it doesn't just happen in the book. He can be anything.
I just think, like, whatever your taste, there's a vampire for you. Like, you know, if you're not fancying glittery Edward Cullen, if you don't like capes, if you're not looking for, vampiric She-Ra, there's always something in one of the folklores you're going to find your type.
Everything from Tom Cruise to Brad Pitt.
That's not a huge...
The full range... of a tall, attractive man to less tall, attractive man. The entire gamut... I think it's another 5. I mean, hey, maybe this is I was about to say white guilt. Is there a version of het guilt? Does that exist? Is that a thing?
I think you just created it. Yeah,
I just created it. Well, if anyone were going to do it, it was going to be me. I think it's 5 out of 5. I would feel very weird about anything less than that.
Yeah. Even with old. Old Gary Oldman looking like a testicle.
Old Gary Oldman. Oh, maybe you're right. Yeah.
And actually, Sheridan Lefanu's particular version.
He can become cool, edgy Gary Oldman in the top hat and the blue sunglasses.
Yeah.
And the long hair.
So what do you think, James? What's the score?
Yeah, I think it is 5.
Even with the hair?
Yeah, because...
Even with the white hair?
I mean, that's his hair's quite sexualized.
Mm.
In that it looks like a pair of testicles.
Yep, this is the first episode I think we've done which has been mostly bleep.
Mm-mm. I take pride in that for some reason.
So, Queer as Folklore, it's a book. How can people get it? How can people find out more about your work, Sasha?
Thank you. It's still being written. That does not mean that you can't pre-order it. In fact, I would ask, if you're interested, please do. I've never been an author before, so it's all kind of new to me. But from what I'm told, pre-orders means that we actually get better of a chance of getting it into the bookshops and things. So if it is your kind of thing, it's a book where every chapter is a different mythical creature. And then it sort of expounds on that. So we do mermaids, witches, unicorns, vampires. But within folklore, I'm including aliens and robots and superheroes. So the ancient history of robots through a queer lens, if that sounds weird enough to tempt you to pre-order it, then you can go and search Queer as Folklore. It's on Unbound, which is my publisher. And you can get yourself a pre-order there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I bet people will find that very interesting.
Yeah, thank you very much. That was brilliant.
Thank you. I had an absolute blast.
Now, you can hop along to Unbound, where you can support Sasha by pre-ordering Queer as Folklore, if you want. As a published novelist, I can confirm that pre-orders do help. So if that sounds like it's your cup of tea, please do check it out.
What if someone wanted to listen to, like, an extra half an hour of our chat with Sasha? How would they do that? Could they go to simply...
Patreon.com/lawmenpod.
Yes.
Of course! That's how they could do it.
And yeah, enjoy.
Yeah, it's quite a lot ruder.
Oh, yeah. It's
all the rude bits went into... It's a lawmen late.
It is lawmen late. It's about time we had someone who'd written a book on the podcast.
It is. It absolutely is.
Although it turns out we had one all along.
Yeah, it was me.
Because you wrote that book.
I wrote it. I did write a book, yeah. I wrote another one.
One day we'll have someone who's read a book on the podcast.
One day.
No, I've unlikely. Obviously read the novelization of the Goonies. Or at least looked at the pictures in the middle.